Good afternoon. It's 1 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon, 1:05 to be exact. On a Tuesday afternoon, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name is Tuli Kharalambos. I'm your host for today, and I'm joined in studio by the beautiful Ranjini Munasamy from the Daily Maverick, our chief political writer and associate editor. Ranjini, we've changed the formula a little bit on the show since the last time you've been on. We've been trying to lighten things up a little bit.
Yes, I haven't been here for a long time.
And it's always good to have you back. So
yeah, and it's a great privilege because I believe it's Mr. Cliff's birthday.
Yes, it is. And cupcakes and coffee abound. Not sure if he's still around, but if he is, we'll give him a wave through the studio doors, through the studio windows. So, Ranjini, we've changed the formula a little bit. We're trying to lighten things up in the beginning. And we have usually come up with a little bit of a fact of the day, something random to kind of get us going. And did you know that the U.S. Copyright Office recently updated its regulations? Mm-hmm. And it updated its regulations to incorporate the following changes. The office will not register works produced by nature, animals, or plants. Likewise, the office cannot register work purportedly created by divine or supernatural beings, although the office may register a work where the application or the deposit copies state that the work was inspired by a divine spirit.
Oh, wow.
So basically, if you're an animal, plant, or a god, you cannot lay a copyright claim on the U.S. Copyright Office.
Oh, you know what that means? Is that nobody can copyright Jacob Zuma's laughter now. We all can't go,
What, because he's a plant, animal, or god?
Demigod.
All right, a demigod. Well, it could have been either two out of three, I think we could have done. But this is off the back of a case that was brought before the U.S. Copyright Office where a photographer was in, I think it was the Indonesian forest, and his camera got appropriated by a monkey. And this monkey took a selfie of itself. And, you know, I'll show you that. We'll tweet this pic so you got there. It's actually quite a good, great monkey selfie.
Oh, it looks like a lead essay selfie. Sorry, that's very bitchy.
Right, and this
nothing irritates me more than lead essay selfies, by the way. So
yeah, I can think of one or two things, but so this selfie made it onto Wikimedia, which is a database of media that is published under Creative Commons license, which means that people can reuse the media without having to pay for it. And the photographer claimed that, no, the camera was his or hers and therefore belonged to him. And Wikimedia claimed, no, the monkey took the selfie and therefore the copyright belonged to the monkey. And that was how the case came before it. And from that, the U.S. Copyright Office updated its laws to say no plants, animals, or gods may lay claim to copyright copyright law.
Well, that's very interesting because sometimes, you know, people are not really appreciative of journalism. So they say, like, any monkey with a camera can do that. So it's good to get clarity on it.
It's incredible how in focus and how good this selfie is.
Yes.
You know,
it's a great selfie.
Yeah, I've never
really
been
need
able
to tweet it.
Yeah. Okay. So I know you've got a tweet of the week for us that we can get onto. But before we go there, because that's going to kind of lead us into the next step and our major discussion for today's show, is I've got a tweet, sort of a little bit left field, but you know, made me chuckle. Was the guy who wrote Hitler's speeches was a grammar Nazi?
Oh, very good.
that kind of made my day. I thought that was really good. You had a tweet. What was the tweet that kind of stood out
to
you this week?
Okay, you know, in the midst of the commotion on Thursday in Parliament, so nobody really knew what was going on. It was kind of a free for all. And then John Flismas tweets, "Whatever you do, nation, nobody phone Cyril." And I think that was hysterical because, especially with riot cops being called in and things, you know, and the South African riot cops being as trigger happy as they are, and I think Cyril Ramaphosa in the mix, calling for concomitant action, would have definitely, you know, inflamed things more than usual. So I thought that was quite, you know, a brilliant tweet in the midst of all that.
Yeah, if you see the mortuary vans starting to line up outside at the beginning of Parliament session, you kind of know it's not going to be a good day for the opposition. We've just been joined by Hagen. Hagen, thanks for making it. We're worried. I know your hair appointment must have gone over. And
no, it was actually a child mining appointment,
oh,
but, cool. And a victim of the Stravonia Road traffic. But we live to tell the tale.
And you hear
have a childminder?
No, that's the problem. That's the problem. I'm the childminder.
It's okay, Hagen. If it was a hair appointment, we're not going to judge. We don't judge.
No, I do keep hair appointments, but just not today.
Okay. We've just done the tweet of the week and a fact. You just missed it. The fact that we had was that the U.S. Copyright Office. I don't know if you saw that news, but the U.S. Copyright Office updated its regulations to say that any works that an animal, plant, or god cannot lay claim to copyright in the U.S. Copyright Office, which is off the back of a monkey that took a selfie and the photographer claimed it was his and Wikimedia said it was the monkey's. Anyway, the Copyright Office ruled in favor of the photographer.
The human.
The human.
Yeah. So you have to be a human.
The monkey wasn't able to argue its case, apparently.
Fair enough. I've got a great tweet if I can squeeze one in.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I was looking it up during the time where Man United were busy losing.
Or not winning.
Just terribly not winning. And there's just this tweet from this guy who calls himself Crazy Kagawa. And he says, Malcolm Glazer must be turning in his grave to see the club he built reduced to rubble. As if.
Well, A, that he built, and B, that, you know, a draw is turning to rubble.
Exactly.
You know? Although, you know, by
one from six is not great, though.
No, it's not great. But, you know, this is what Dave Moyes is doing. He's fist pumping right now.
Oh, yes.
He had a better start to the season.
Exactly.
I think, you know.
Yeah, and they had such an amazing preseason. So it's actually interesting how...
I don't know why we're discussing English Premier League, because we didn't have a great night either.
No, we didn't. What Premier League? What is this Premier League thing you speak of?
Are they Liverpool fans in the house?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, I'm Chelsea, so things are looking very good. There we go. Blue is the colour.
Quite interesting. I don't know if you've, well, you probably haven't, but the financial statements of Chelsea Football Club for the last 10 years make for some very interesting reading. In the last 10 years, well, since Roman Abramovich has taken over, only one out of the last 10 years has the club actually turned a profit. It is technically and factually, well, it's technically insolvent. The only thing keeping it afloat is the fact that Roman has signed an unsubordinated loan to say that he won't lay claim to the loan that he's given to the club in order for it to carry on operating. So it's actually technically insolvent.
But is that not the case with a couple of clubs?
Well, with quite a lot of clubs. I mean, there's a lot of dodgy accounting and creative accounting that goes back. I know Real Madrid, for example, sold the stadium to the city council for a hugely inflated price and then leased it back. So it's all sort of crazy creative accounting going on.
Mm. And it's just inflating salaries for players.
Yeah. And it begs the question, how long can this go on for? It's obviously gone on for quite a long time, but surely there's got to be an end to...
Particularly when the country that's doing the best in Europe is Germany, and they've got the most reasonable transfer fees, and they've built an organic development system, and, you know, they're Champions League and World Cup champions. So it also begs the question.
And attracts some of the biggest crowds across Europe as well. So kind of ticking all the boxes without having to go to these crazy extremes.
And these sort of millionaire players, and it's debatable how much value they're really bringing.
I read somewhere that the PSL, funny enough, is in the top 10 or 15 richest leagues in the world.
Wow. You wouldn't say that by the performance.
Well,
yeah?
not best quality play.
Yeah.
Well, that and you know, I've seen some of the salaries of the coaches and some of the players, and I mean, the people are turning down European offers to stay in the PSL because there's actually that much money.
Probably on the back of SuperSport's TV money.
That and obviously continental TV rights is generating a lot of a lot of money for the league. But it's crazy. People don't really realize that, you know, it's that rich and powerful. But I think it's the performances of the national team and obviously these players feeding into the national team that detract from that perception.
Well,
that
I mean,
quality league.
You could make a case for the money in the league being responsible for the lower quality because, as you've said, the players aren't going to Europe to play there. They stay here, it becomes like a small pond, quality, you know, doesn't rise, and players that would otherwise go and gain experience playing in Europe aren't, and
well, that's true. It's not like the football stars who come into the, you know, the twilight of their career are exactly coming to South Africa to finish off, you know, like the David Beckhams of the world.
Not much of that.
It's like lazy louts living in the parents' home, and their mom gets to do their laundry and cook their food. Well, so they why leave?
Exactly. No, that's an interesting point.
Still living in a bunk bed at 31.
But that's the point, right? You don't have to work that hard to get the big bucks anymore, because previously you had to go and sort of fight for it tooth and nail in Europe to be able to get the
Benny
money.
McCarthy's, you know, either they go to Europe and then they don't want to play for Bafana, or they just don't go. You know, a lot of those.
No, they go to Europe and then start rapping or singing or whatever the hell Benny McCarthy did.
Eating.
Yeah.
There was some of that.
Okay, let's get back to the hard news stuff, the stuff that making the front pages of the Daily Maverick. And obviously the biggest story from this last week has obviously been the fracas in Parliament. You know, the explosion of EFF and payback, hashtag payback the money. Ranjini, maybe take us back to the beginning. You know, take us back to the sort of the source of this, you know, this outrage in Parliament, and, you know, and why it was the EFF that was, I mean, it's not unexpected that it's the EFF leading the charge.
Okay, so you remember the Public Protector released her report in March. She gave Jacob Zuma 14 days to respond to that report. I think it's been like 4 months.
140.
Yeah. You know, and the president kept on postponing his response and said he was waiting for this and that and SIU report and whatever else. And eventually he ran out of time and had to respond. And his response was rather pathetic. It was a 20-page report which basically went through the key findings of the Public Protector's report, the Government Task Team report, and the SIU report. He didn't speak of anything in particular that Thuli Madonsela had found, including that he had violated the Executive Ethics Act. And you would think that a sitting president would want to defend that, especially, you know, if somebody found that he has been in violation, you would think that, you know, here's your opportunity. Say, I didn't. Explain it. He didn't even bother to do that. So he submitted this report to Parliament, basically saying, I've noted all this. I don't want to comment about it. And the Minister of Police, the new Minister of Police, will determine whether I should, if any, whether I should pay back anything to the state for the security upgrades.
And that being based on the fact that, A, he obviously had a hand in appointing the police minister, but also the fact that, what was the argument that Nkandla is a key point, and the key points are sort of fall under the police department,
and also
police ministry.
The police were the ones who oversaw the upgrades together with Public Works. So he thinks that, you know, the bulletproof glass and whatever else, you know, that's a police issue, not his issue. Except that's not what Thuli Madonsela said in her report. She was talking about the fire pool. Well, she called it a swimming pool, sadly for him. The amphitheater, the cattle kraal, the chicken run. There was one other thing. I can't think what it was now.
Was it the sewage? There was sewage plant or so. There was some kind of sewage filtration system or something that was. I remember reading that. That was also part of the
These other things were undue benefits, and that's what she said. He should pay a reasonable percentage, and she said that he, together with the National Treasury, needs to determine what that amount should be, and he needs to pay it back. Except he just disregarded what she said and said, oh, the police minister will decide whether I should pay back and how much that should be, if anything. So I think this is what set the cat among the pigeons. So, you know, the rest of us can bleat about it and say, actually, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. And government simply disregards it. The presidency doesn't even bother to respond. The problem was when he went to Parliament and had to face questions. Now, Julius Malema's question, he had to submit it like three weeks back. So when he submitted the question for oral reply, he didn't know the president would have already responded by then. So his question to the president was, when are you responding to the Public Protector's report? So the president then responds with one line saying, I have done so last week. Goodbye. You know, and that's the end of the question. Except, unfortunately for the president, Malema gets to ask a supplementary question based on his response. And that's what started the trouble, because Julius Malema then said, excuse me, that was hardly a response. When are you paying back the money? When are you giving a proper response to the report? And that started with the mayhem, because then the ANC MP started jumping up saying the matter is now before the ad hoc committee in Parliament. They will decide it. And Malema refused to accept that answer. He said, I'm not worried about the parliamentary committee. When are you paying back the money? That's not up for discussion. You know, the ad hoc committee that set up a parliament is supposed to look at how the president responded and assess that. But Thuli Madonsela's recommendation still stands. It's not up for discussion. The only way you can challenge that is if you go to court and try and set aside her recommendations, which what the presidency hasn't done. So what they've done is they said, oh, well, when we get to the ad hoc committee in parliament, there's the overwhelming majority of members, 8 out of 12 are ANC members, so they're going to squash it there. So, you know, that's problem dealt with.
So what they're really trying to do is undermine the authority of the public protector by creating
the Constitution and the laws, competing
authorities, whereas she's been created as the Chapter 9 institution that is supposed to be the final word. But
And the Minister of Police doesn't have the legal authority to overrule her recommendation. And that's what she then, on that same day, that Thursday, while the commotion was going on, she then wrote to the president and pointed all these things out. So you have these two things playing out simultaneously. Of course, many of people would have seen it live or saw it subsequently in footage. It was incredible scenes in Parliament, because the EFF got really, really angry. They got up, they were banging their tables, demanding pay back the money, and they kept chanting. And the Speaker of Parliament just lost control completely. Mm. She started screaming. ANC MPs were screaming. It was complete mayhem. The EFF MPs refused an instruction from her to leave the house. They remained in the house. She eventually called for the sergeant at arms. They weren't able to evict the EFF, and eventually she suspended the house. But the key thing here is that the mace of parliament remained in place, which means the session was still ongoing when she suspended parliament. So that mace that sits at the front, it's very important, because it means that you preserve parliamentary privilege while that thing is in place. But what happened is that the riot police was called in, and they were stomping all inside the house, inside the chamber, while the mace was in place. Now, up to this morning, we didn't know who would have called them in.
So who's really disrespecting parliamentary procedure?
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Because it seems that the speaker, up to this morning, we thought possibly it was the speaker's office, and surely they would have known the mace is in place. You cannot have any member of the public, let alone police, armed policemen with guns, batons, shields, stomping around the house.
Enforcing what, really?
Yes, exactly.
The no noise rule. I mean, it's the most interesting thing that's happened in Parliament, the most passionate expression of views. And for me, that's what Parliament has lacked, is really passionate opinion.
Two interesting points there, Ranjini. So the first one is, when I saw this happening, a parallel that struck me was the service delivery protests from the last year and running up to the elections. And the fact being that the normal channels of communication, the normal channels of complaints, just aren't working. So what you've got to do, and this is what everyone who engaged in those service delivery protests realized, was the only way that you got coverage, the only way you got your voice heard, was to engage in something that got the attention of the government, got the attention of the ANC, and attention of the media. And unfortunately, that was burning tires, that was engaging in violence.
Breach of the peace.
Yeah, and for me, this was kind of a parallel to that. I mean, the parliamentary parallel to that was that those normal channels of oppositions and complaints, lodging, and all that just seemed to be tossed to the side. Mm. And the only way was ultimate frustration, obviously a little bit of grandstanding, and which I think we can almost accept as part of the EFF's media strategy. But I don't know if you agree with that sentiment, that there was a parallel to be drawn,
absolutely.
There's no other way. This is what we have to do.
Yeah, people aren't being listened to, and particularly the poor people in the service delivery context that you're mentioning, and also in Parliament. I mean, Tony Leon made a point that the ANC has subverted the effectiveness of Parliament through its majority, so that, you know, they can use points of order and procedure and their overwhelming majority in committees to just ensure that, you know, b- bills get passed with just, I don't know, the most basic of debate, and that's really not democracy either. So then to say that banging on tables and being loud is an assault on democracy, you know, they don't really compare. I mean, they just, again, an expression of frustration.
The other thing that also struck me was also the role of the speaker in this entire, I mean, like it degenerated to the point that it got their main, a lot of blame can be lamed at Baleka Mbete's feet because of what happened, the riot police being called in. And it made us look to the role of the speaker in and the impartiality of the speaker in other countries as well. And I think it's the UK where effectively once you're appointed, you have to resign as a member of the party that you come from just to maintain that impartiality. And I think, you know, we saw a very poor example of impartiality at play. You know, the finger wagging, the calling of the sergeant at arms, the allowing of the president to hide behind those points of order and hide behind answers that weren't acceptable to most members of parliament and members of the public, but it almost, you know, allowing the president to shield himself from those questions.
Yes, we must remember that the Speaker of Parliament is also the national chairperson of the ANC. So she, you know, it was quite obvious from her conduct on Thursday that she was there to protect the president and make sure that he doesn't face the kind of heat that the EFF wanted. And, you know, the thing is that President Zuma, since he took power in 2009, has been so accustomed to going to parliament, just saying whatever he wants to say, and then leaving. He's never been challenged this vigorously before. Lindiwe Mazibuko was in the last term. She did try her best to hold him to account. But the thing is that the processes of parliament just doesn't allow it. If the president refuses to answer or dodges an answer, there is absolutely nothing within the rules that compels him to do so. So opposition parties have little option, or, you know, there's not much they can do if he is evasive. So what happened is that Julius Malema and the EFF then stepped over the mark by shouting, "No answer. Answer when you're going to pay back." And I think this is why we've now strayed into uncharted territory, where it's clear that the EF breached the rules of parliament by not following the orders of the speaker, but that there is some justification for their actions because it is clear that the country is demanding accountability on Nkandla, and we're just not getting it. There's all sorts of processes that are circumventing normal processes. And the person, I think, who is consistently pointing this out now is the public protector. She's pointed it out in a letter she wrote to the president, which was carried in some media over the weekend. And the letter has been subsequently released. But now the ANC is attacking her for doing precisely that, for pointing out what's wrong with the president's response. So you've got two fronts, basically. You've got the EFF with this very loud, boisterous,
brash,
a protest in parliament. And Julius Malema was in court yesterday. He was saying, "You ain't seen nothing yet. We're still coming back for more." And then on the other hand, you've got the public protector going a very legal way. And, you know, she speaks in all this legalese. And she keeps on pointing them, "Listen, you're in danger of breaching the constitution. Mm-hmm. You're going to, stray into territory where the rule of law is going to be disrespected. You are encouraging criminality and illegality by conducting yourselves in this way." And this is why now you find the hound dogs are out. You know, the ANC and the SACP is now attacking the public protector. Mm. They claim she leaked her letter. They claim that she is the one in breach of the constitution by writing to the president. She's not respecting parliament. So, you know, then you've had this extraordinary thing that happened this morning where the security cluster ministers came out and announced that they will be taking tougher action against whoever, you know, behaves in this way in parliament again. Now, that is totally unprecedented. They're using terms like law and order. You know, in parliament, it's completely bizarre.
And fascism and drawing and Nazi rebels. Analogies. That's really
they're calling the EFF rebels when they were democratically elected. 1.1 million people voted for them. You can't get away from
and
that.
And for me, if anything, they're increasing the public interest in parliament, which has waned because being a rubber stamp parliament so that effectively the country's being run out of Luthuli House. And if you're actually managing to take the ANC on head on in Parliament, there's a lot more eyeballs on Parliament, and people become aware of that. I haven't watched like the parliamentary channel in years, and now it's riveting watching, you know. So it's almost making Parliament more relevant, even though they might be bending the rules a little.
Well, that's what Julia said, is that they didn't know how to react, because this is the first time they're actually having opposition, opposition that's willing to stand up and, you know, cross those lines, because the normal channels just aren't working.
Mm.
Peter Foss wrote a column today in Daily Maverick comparing the response of the government, / ANC, to Thuli Madonsela's letters as the way an alcoholic would respond to a family intervention by pointing out the faults of the family members who are overstepping the line. Who are you to say I have a problem? And I thought that was quite a great analogy, because I mean the sort of knee jerk reactions, the sort of personal attacks, and a lot of them without basis, and referring to law and ways that she's overstepping the mark. Meanwhile, you know, if anyone really knows it, you know, to the T, it's probably her.
And they're basically saying it's a personal crusade on her part. They're accusing her of not doing her job. That she's got some personal vendetta, which is absolutely crazy.
Or it might be that she's doing her job too well.
Yeah, and not towing the line, which is in a lot of places what is people's job descriptions. Your job description here is to toe the line,
and rubber stamp what we want to happen.
The party line. Ranj, we spoke about this earlier. I mean, this thing is going, you know, it's crazy. It's consuming the media. It's consuming the front pages. And Nkandla is this massive topic. But we compare that to something like Marikana, for example. And we talk about this often, about Marikana fatigue. Credit to our editor. He keeps going and keeps pushing it, because it was this massive event, this huge tragedy. And then we compare that against something like Nkandla, where yes, it is a big thing, but money is being misspent and power is being abused. But Marikana claimed the lives of 34 people, and depending on which documentaries you watch and what coverage you follow, we could say that they were basically slaughtered. And it was a massacre. But the public attention and the media attention on Marikana, just we can't compare the two. And I guess it's, you know, Parliament and obviously this grandstanding that's happening keeps it in the limelight. But why is this? It feels like there's a big disparity between the two. Is it because we can pinpoint Nkandla to the foot of Jay-Z's empire and him directly, and him, he needs to be accountable? And Marikana, it's quite difficult to find out who exactly. Is it Cyril? Is it the Minister of Police? Is it, you know, Susan Chibangu? Is it because it's so difficult to find out? What's your take on why is this the disparity between the two, or perceived disparity? Maybe it's just myself.
To answer that, I think the question to be asked is, what is the value of human life? We know the value of Nkandla is 246 million, but what is the value of the lives of those 34 mine workers? And I think the answer to that is relative to who you are in society. If those had been 34 lawyers, okay, maybe lawyers wouldn't have been a bad example. Okay, so, I mean,
it's,
you know,
the 34 Generations Act.
Yeah, exactly.
We've lost them too.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, they stopped acting. You know, they didn't stop living.
You've touched on a good point about it being a class-based issue, and if you're going to really question the issues around Marikana, it's really about structural economic systems that are at issue. Like, is capitalism working? And it's really deep issues which forces, you know, the whole of society to question itself, whereas Nkandla is very much a cut and dried case of misspending.
Yeah, but the thing also is that, you know, mine workers, the Marikana happened far away from our lives. It's easy for the middle class and opinion makers and tweeters and the commentariat to distance themselves from what happened at Marikana, to say, you know, it's people who, and by the way, they were on strike. You know, there were, there's always this argument that
weapons,
yes, exactly,
opportunity to spin your way out.
There's always a way to, you know, to distance yourself from it and say, well, you know, it's happened. You know, and there is a commission of inquiry, and maybe we should wait. And you know, that's what's really, really unfair about it, because you know, those are human beings. They have families. They were breadwinners. They are the people who turned the wheels of this economy. South Africa's economy depends largely on mining. You know, and those people, the diggers of dirt, are the, you know, they live in horrible conditions. They do really, really hard work. But you know, it's difficult for us to be able to empathize with their plight. Now, I think the difference with Nkandla is that it's almost like a lasting monument to corruption. It's there, you know. It's
permanent.
It's visible. Permanent. Yes, and I think, you know, the level of arrogance around Nkandla and the way it's been handled. You know, like for example, the fire pool issue, where for a long time, you know, that stupid issue like that. You know, obviously a swimming pool. What the hell would you have in the middle of an estate? You know, and you had the National Police Commissioner trying to argue that no, actually it is a firefighting mechanism because there's no stairs in the pool. So, you know, that's what
there's a diving board.
So, you know, I think that this is what has caused this much of anger and annoyance about it, is because from the beginning, it's been a duck and dive mission to, you know, to prevent any form of accountability about it. And I think the level of overspending has also been, you know, just so outrageous. You know, 246, basically a quarter of a billion rand. Just, it's not even on building the house, it's just upgrading it. You know, so I think this is what has caused the issue to be as inflamed as it was, and with why it remains on the agenda. And I think this is also why the opposition can keep on banging on about it, you know, to their heart's content, because it is an issue that remains relevant. It is the top of the national agenda, and the ANC can't run away from it.
Do we need to change rules in Parliament to allow for a more effective opposition to take place? Do we need to have an impartial speaker? Do we need to, in this whole hiding behind, basically what, I mean, it probably started from Thabo's era in terms of, you know, removing the powers of an effective opposition within Parliament. Do we need to look at changing those rules within Parliament?
Well, I think Balega Mbete is a particularly bad Speaker of Parliament, because mostly because...
A bad choice?
Yes. Because she can't, you know, she's not able to control things, and she lets her emotions get the better of her. I think Max Sisulu was much better in that position. She's very level-headed, and, you know, he is able to call to order anyone and tell everyone to get off on either side of the house. So what that shows you is that it's not so much... you know, the rules rather than the personalities that are chosen. And the ANC, I think, has learned his lesson with Max Sisulu, because he was, you know, quite an independent person in the way he conducted himself. He, in fact, allowed the opposition to call for that ad hoc committee in the last term, which the ANC was extremely angry about. So with regard to the speaker, I don't think, you know, that there is a need. I think that, you know, that there just needs to be more... of an effort to choose a better personality.
And respect for the institution.
Yes.
Like if the speaker sees that role as a calling, like I'm really doing something important for the country and perform that role.
Rather than being a party hack.
Like a deployee, like you're basically a cadre who's been deployed to be the speaker. I mean, that's not the right way for it to be seen, but it seems that way.
Yes. So with regard to the rules pertaining to debates and question time, I think there's definitely room to maneuver there. But the bizarre thing is that the ANC is now agitating for change in the rules, not to address that issue of the lack of accountability, but instead to make sure there's more of a clampdown. From what the security cluster ministers were saying this morning, you know, they want more of a clampdown in Parliament to rein things in. So they're going completely the opposite direction. They don't see what the problem is here. Mm. They're not reading the public mood.
Do they have authority over Parliament?
No, they don't. This is
I mean, that's the judicial arm, and we're talking about the legislative arm. Isn't there a measure of independence.
Judiciary is to do with the executive arm. The executive is exerting authority over the legislature.
Right.
Which is completely wrong. So that is why one of the journalists at the press conference this morning looked at that whole table of security cluster ministers and said, is this a coup? Because that's what happens in a coup.
Yeah.
Is that the executive takes over, you know, the military, because the Minister
security
of Defense was the one running that press conference, you know, dictating to Parliament what should happen in Parliament. So, you know, it's, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if they call in the Amabarete into Parliament, you know, to cock their guns every time the opposition wants to ask the president a hard question. You know, they're not reading the public mood. And I was quite astounded by the defense minister this morning when journalists were trying to explain to her, but what are you doing? You know, this is outrageous. Why are you imposing these are heavy-handed measures? And she starts lecturing the media to say, you know, this was wrong. This is not supposed to happen. And, you know, it disrupted peace. People were banging on tables. Excuse me, children in classrooms bang on tables now and then. It doesn't mean that you send in the riot police.
I think it's just vibrant democracy at work. And such an overreaction is doing infinitely more damage than people banging hard hats on tables.
I think something that epitomized the perception and the lack of reading the public mood was the presidency's response to what had happened in Parliament, and the fact that Nkandla wasn't mentioned once in the initial response, and basically just went on about the disorder and the misbehavior, and nothing about the fact that, you know, that Nkandla was mentioned in the response, or the fact that the questions weren't answered adequately to members of Parliament's expectations.
You know? I think the other frightening thing is, you know, the NC Secretary General, Gwede Mantashe, is an extremely powerful and influential person. You saw in Gupta Gate, everyone hung back after the plane landed, but as soon as Gwede pronounced on it, you know, you had the whole security cluster and government jumping up and down to deal with the crisis. So what he did immediately on Thursday afternoon, he went out on radio and said, why is the state not acting against these people? They should have gone in and arrested. Now, that shows an astounding ignorance about how Parliament works and the rules of parliamentary privilege, because the Constitution, not even any ARB law, but the Constitution spells out that no member of Parliament can be arrested in the House for anything they say in the House. And that's what they were doing. The EFF was saying, pay back the money. You can't arrest them for saying that. But he was demanding on public platforms from Thursday, and he's got a press conference at 3 p.m. today. I can bet he's going to say the same thing, that the state should have taken action. And I think that is terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
I mean, doesn't it feel like we're headed down this slippery slope? I mean, we're talking about changes being proposed to make it even more draconian, or to make it even more in favor of the sitting government, to effectively nullify any sort of constructive opposition in Parliament. I mean, it sounds like a scary slope.
It's terrifying, and what it risks doing is making Parliament even more irrelevant.
Mm.
And with the EFF being a bit of a little pressure valve for the poor who might not feel represented, that they do have a voice in Parliament. If you silence that, that leaves the streets as the only outlet.
Only outlet, right.
And then we're back to, you know, 1988, you know, where Parliament was irrelevant and, you know, real democracy and expression was secured on the streets.
Just touching on that, we've just had a tweet come through on the Cliff Central line. The ANC are petrified because someone is talking for the people and standing up to their mafia organization. So I guess in a little bit more of a direct terminology, mafia organization, is that that's where someone is standing up. Someone is standing up to their bullying and not taking the crap, basically. And it's scary to think what you say is that if we close off that channel, then it's anarchy, basically, is the only option.
And then, ironically, then you start getting like fascist tendencies within the ANC if they're gonna bully their way to getting what they want. And one hopes it doesn't come to that.
Runch, you said Gillis was quoted as saying, "You ain't seen nothing yet." you know, what's the next step for them? I mean, what are the, you know, what do you expect them to come on? What is the next thing? Are they going to keep flogging this this till they get the answer they're looking for?
Well, I think this issue like landed in their laps because, you know, although the ANC is accusing that whole thing on Thursday of being pre-planned, you could see it evolved as it happened. I don't think that, you know, that the EFF anticipated, you know, that, that situation would reach that extent. I don't think they intended on having a sit-in in parliament and police being called in. I think what they had intended to do is put pressure on the president. I even think pay back the money happened naturally. It didn't
spontaneously.
Look, it happened spontaneously after Julius asked the president the question, and that's when, you know, the chant evolved. But I think, you know, for them, this is a campaign now made for them because they've got, you know, political capital which wasn't there before. They're getting support from constituencies that were totally opposed to them. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that the Democratic Alliance, although they are the official opposition, I think that they, like, almost overwhelmed by the situation. And from that Thursday afternoon, they adopted more like a fence-sitting kind of position on it, where they said the speaker was wrong, but the EFF was wrong. But
their behavior was wrong.
Yes, yeah. You know. So I think society has moved past that point now. I think society is demanding answers. The DA is not able to put enough pressure on the president and the ANC to get those answers. And I think only the EFF is able to do
in
that.
The way they've stolen the DA's issue.
Yes.
That was their pet issue, was Nkandla. And now EFF have basically taken it over.
In fact, the original complainant on to the public protector was Lindiwe Mazibuko.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but now the issue is completely gone from the DA. They've lost it. And the EFF is the one that's pioneering it now. They are the champions of the Nkandla issue. So, look, I don't quite know where they're going to take it. But I think what they know is that the more mayhem and the more that they exist outside the confines of parliamentary rules, the more the ANC is going to react illogically. And that's where they want to push it. They want to force a crisis on Nkandla. And I think we are heading for a constitutional crisis with the face-off between the president and the public protector on one hand. And I think you're going to have another one where there is going to be this attempted clampdown on a political party in parliament, which is also unconstitutional. So you're going to have a double constitutional crisis all around Nkandla.
And as well as the prospect of a street fight, which is basically the EFF's sort of approach here, is that you've got this legal channel that Thuli and the Public Protector's Office is taking against the Nkandla issue, and then you've got this like street fighting approach. Which
and there's
the
another front, obviously, within the ANC, because there are a lot of principled people within the ANC, and it's not a homogenous block, and there's got to be a point where people within the ANC start asking whether it's worth, you know, risking everything just to protect the president.
Yeah, one ANC veteran was saying to me the other day, you know, this issue for people like me, meaning people like him, is like asking which do you prefer, Israel or Hamas? You know, what do you say? There is no lesser evil. You know, how do you try and justify anything? So it's best to just keep quiet and you know, just, but I think it's going to come to a stage where, you know, more people are going to become extremely restless in the ANC, and you've seen this already, you know, that there is discomfort. The ANC in Gauteng paid a heavy price for it in the election, because Nkandla was a major issue in the middle classes in Gauteng. But I think the more the ANC misreads the mood in society, and the more the ANC continues to think its role is to defend the president on this issue, it's going to alienate its constituency, it's going to alienate its traditional supporters. And I don't know when, at what point they stop and say, let's change tactics, this is not working.
Well, it seems to me there can only be disastrous circumstances for towing that line, both for the ANC and for the public, because the ANC is going to lose credibility, it's going to lose support, and we're going to lose institutions and sort of the channels and the ability to have our voices heard and to be able to stand up against something that is as corrupt as Nkandla. Mm-hmm. So on both fronts, we, you know, there's just destructive outcomes of what's going to happen. Our time's almost up. I sound like a shrink on the couch here, but I want to ask you guys two questions each. One is, what do you think is going to happen? And what would you like to happen out of this Nkandla situation that's happening. So, Ranj, okay, maybe you can go first. What do you think is going to happen?
What I think is that the NC is just going to become more and more illogical in the arguments, and they're going to try, you know, from the NC side and from government side, they're just going to, you know, go completely, you know, militaristic about this and try and clamp down on the EFF and hit out at the, continue to hit out at the public protector until you're facing a complete and utter constitutional crisis. What I think should they should do is say, Mr. President, just answer the question and just pay back the money. You know, that's what should happen. Even if he pays like 1,000 rand and say, okay, I'll pay 1,000 rand now and like we'll do it later. It's an acknowledgement that something went wrong and a commitment to, you know, say, okay, let's move on from this issue. Until they do that, until they have, because he's not going to come to that realization on his own. Until the ANC says to him, Mr. President, just let's move on because you are destroying this party, you're destroying the institutions of government, in breaching the constitution. Let's please just deal with this issue. And the only way to deal with it is to respond properly to the public protector's report and pay back the money. I certainly hope that at some stage reason prevails and that happens. I don't see it happening though.
And just to clarify, by payback money, we're not talking about the whole 246 million. It's all just those which pertain to security.
And it's not even
the non-security upgrades.
It probably won't even be that much.
No, it won't, because it's for the you see, it's the chicken run, the amphitheater, the swimming pool, the cattle kraal, and whatever. I think those things came to 20 million.
20 million, yes.
But
right,
she didn't even say pay 20 million. Yeah, she said a reasonable percentage. Mm-hmm. So it could be, say, 1 million.
Yeah, I think she also left it open to say, well, we know there were a lot of inflated prices there.
She almost gave him a little get out of jail. It was like, pay even just a token amount, just something.
Well, here's a suggestion. Let's charge the Guptas for using Vortica. you know, for
exactly.
And let's charge them, you know, 10 bars and we can use that to pay back the money.
And let's donate them to Lesotho after that.
Hagen, what's your take on what should happen and what you think will happen?
Well, I think I agree with Ranjini. The ANC's got to accept that the principle is valid. There was misspending and the president needs to pay something back. Unfortunately, it's become such a head-to-head conflict that they don't want to be seen to back down. So what they might do is kind of finesse it, block it for now, and then maybe a few months down the line, there'll be some like concession. But if that doesn't happen, what you're really seeing, I think, is an assault on democracy in every party almost. Like you find like the ANC is being run by authoritarians, the DA is, the EFF is, and there's almost scope for some political realignment within the next 5 years. And one even looks maybe somewhere like, I don't know, Ivan Jim or somewhere, that there's scope for someone who really makes democracy the keystone of their platform, because everybody's paying lip service to it, but the more you look at it, there's it's not being protected.
I guess the scariest thing and the biggest thing here is that we don't end up with results or with circumstances that end up negatively affecting our democracy out of this. You know, so these rules that are being proposed, the, you know, to be able to come in and remove, you know, members of parliament, for example, just by voicing opposition in the House. I think, you know, breaking down those democratic structures and continuing to move in that direction is probably one of the scariest things that could come out of this. And that, for me, is the biggest sort of worry out of something like that. And seems to be like we're heading in that direction.
Yeah, you know, my piece on yesterday was how low will the ANC go? You know, will they adopt this scorched earth attitude? We just break everything. You know, and the other thing is that there's so many unintended consequences that flow from this. This morning I was watching the Minister of Defense, Mapisa Ngakula, you know, speaking on these issues, and I just thought, you know, what are you doing? She was running that press conference like a domestic dispute, you know, arguing with journalists. And she's supposed to have a certain air of authority as a Minister of Defense. She's basically running our security forces, you know. God help us if we, like, ever at war. And, you know, she goes and, like, stands on the border and starts, you know,
lose
yelling.
Your temper.
Yeah. But like, you know, this is Women's Month. I probably won't get a chance to talk about this again. This is Women's Month. And I think it was an opportunity for women in different levels in society to display, you know, how far the gender project has come in South Africa and what women are achieving in society. Today alone, you had Mapisa Ngakula in that weird briefing in Parliament. You had Susan Shabangu at the Marikana Commission. You had Faith Mutambi in the Communications Portfolio Committee. All of them, their performance was putrid. It was a disgrace to society, let alone being an example to young women hoping to aspire to power. You know, so what are they doing? Do they not see? I mean, I wish that each of those women can play those recordings, you know, in the privacy of their own homes, play back those recordings and see how the rest of society see them, because they are absolutely shocking in their behavior. They are there in order to protect power. They make the most ridiculous arguments under the sun, and they abuse the positions they are in order to keep the ANC, to defend the ANC. That's their only role. Their role is not advancing women. It's not, you know, doing the jobs they are there to do. And I'm sorry I'm having this rant, but, you know, well, that's my say on Women's Day.
But haven't you just described almost every complaint about the ANC Women's League? You basically would have taken that little soliloquy, not rant, and said that you were describing the ANC Women's League,
yes,
and everything that's wrong with the Women's League, but you know, you now picked some senior people within government who epitomized that.
I mean, this was just in one morning, you know, let alone what happens, you know, every day, things that we see and things that we don't see, you know, that's been happening, and these were just three very public platforms, very important issues in society. Mm. And they were just failing horribly at it. And no wonder the ANC Women's League says that we don't have anybody worthy of being a woman president in South Africa. It's because of these kinds of example of people. I definitely wouldn't want them, any of them, to be running our country.
Paula Brigg has just tweeted that your show is like a breath of fresh air, and I think that's because of our guests here today. I'd like to thank Hagen Engler and Ranjini Munsami for coming in and joining us on the Daily Maverick Show. I'm going to try and play out with a song, Wrecking Ball, but not the Miley Cyrus version. This is the ZA News version of Wrecking Ball. This is Thuli Madonsela in Wrecking Ball, I hope you guys, if you get the opportunity to go and check it out on YouTube or the ZA News site, go check out Thuli Madonsela Wrecking Ball. It's absolutely brilliant. The guys from ZA News are brilliant. And here we go. Until next week, this is goodbye from the Daily Maverick Show.